Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to today's episode of Resounding Echoes. Over the last few weeks, I have spoken at length about how certain composers at the start of the last century, as children of their time, experimented in various ways with increased chromaticism and expanded tonality in an attempt to find what they felt were forms and sounds adequate to their creative needs, which clearly were not being satisfied by traditional means. In this context, I also spoke about the conundrum created by the problem of dispensing with the traditional and dependable rules and procedures of tonality, namely, what framework do we now use around which to structure our musical ideas? Here, I have spoken about the use of counterpoint, alternative scales, modes and meters, and harmony built on non-traditional intervals. Another great repository around which to drape their suggestive sounds was to be found in the warehouse of words. It is not surprising, therefore, to find many of the greatest composers of these years writing a substantial quantity of songs, dealing in drama, and plucking from the most fragrant fruits of pitch-perfect poetry. Doch mein Traum verfolgt nur eines. My dream pursues only one thing. That is the closing line from the second of 15 songs composed by Arnold Schönberg between 1908 and 1909, titled Das Buch der Hängenden Gärten. 15 poems which he selected from a larger collection written by that most French feeling of German poets, Stefan Georg. Prosaically put, the songs tell a tale of an adolescent boy wandering through paradise, imagined by Georg as a garden, the boy's gradual sexual awakening and mounting, tortured, yearning passion, his ultimate discovery of the girl he seeks, their intense and extensive lovemaking, which climaxes with the boy being abandoned by his lover, resulting in the withering and decay of the garden. Schönberg was no stranger to using such stories for inspiration. Despite the fact that many, tiresomely, ignorantly, and disrespectfully, like to portray him as some kind of note-spinning robot, Arnold Schönberg was every inch a child of aesthetically intoxicated turn-of-the-century Vienna. His world was that of Klimt, Freud, Nietzsche, Schnitzler, and Weininger, and he was saturated in it as much as any of his peers. In a world where music was literally the air people breathed, Wagner was like an airless, sultry summer day, making them sweat profusely with his climactic celebrations of erotic love, even at the expense of bourgeois propriety. Schönberg's earlier pieces, Verklärte Nacht, Gute Lieder, and Pelias und Melisande, are all in this vein. They are all heavily influenced by Wagner, not only musically. In Das Buch der Hängenden Gärten, however, he struck out on his own and found a hitherto unknown, unexplored, overgrown path into the wilderness. In talking about the music Schönberg produced in the years 1908 and 1909, many like to focus on his biography. Many do this in a titillating fashion and as a means to cover up the fact that they don't have much, if anything, of relevance or interest to say about the actual extraordinary music. Whilst it would be foolish to deny his biography, not least as it definitively destroys the crass and crude caricatures of Schönberg as some sort of bloodless machine, there is tragically nothing extraordinary about a life story that includes betrayal, heartbreak, and suicide. But not many people compose music, And almost nobody ever composed music anything like as extraordinary as that of one Arnold Schönberg's. So I would rather focus on that. Als neuling trat ich ein in dein Gehege. As a novice, I entered your enclosure. So goes the first line of that, the third song of the cycle. The idea of an enclosure, especially in opposition to the idea of wilderness, is key to understanding, or at least providing a possible interpretation of what lies beneath this tale of boy meets girl, girl beds boy, boy and girl say bye-bye. The use of the analogy of a garden, a walled enclosure to symbolize the notion of nature tamed by culture, a place safe from the wilderness without, has a long lineage that goes back at least to the book of Genesis. Indeed, in the final forlorn song of the cycle, which is twice as long as any other, Georg refers to the now wasted lover's garden as Eden. For what concerns us here, I would like to view the enclosed garden as a symbol of sound tamed by tonality. For Schönberg, by this time, the garden of tonality was keeping out things that he was compelled to give voice to. Just as a good gardener tries to keep out the weeds and the slugs, that doesn't mean they don't exist and the reality isn't true, and they don't have as much right to live and multiply as any traditionally beautiful flower or fruit tree. For Schönberg, tonality and bourgeois culture in general of the time was trying to keep out dissonance and to tame or deny the truth of the irrational, of the instinctual, which in this song cycle takes the form of barely controlled, pulsating, overflowing adolescent libido. As the eighth song emits in a feverish spurt that lasts less than a minute, if I do not touch your body today, the thread of my soul will be rent asunder. Just Just as with the weeds and the slugs, the guardians of music refuse to accept dissonance or totally frank explorations of the unconscious and our instinct, as they were not beautiful or decent or fit to be heard, to paraphrase Virginia Woolf. The fact that they were true was not important. Beauty, decorum, order was what mattered. Keeping the slugs, weeds, and wonderful wildflowers out for the sake of the commoner garden varieties. John Keats wrote Beauty is Truth, Truth Beauty. But for Arnold Schoenberg in 1909, what many of his peers and elders considered beautiful no longer seemed true to him. The idea of beauty encapsulated in Keats's Grecian urn, or the centuries-long European veneration of that idea, seemed to contain little truth for a citizen, and especially a Jewish citizen of Vienna in 1909. The prevailing idea of beauty was erected in the enchanted garden almost as a wall to keep truth out. Many around him seemed to find in the all-pervading aesthetic Weltanschauung of Vienna almost a substitute for ethics. This was never an option for the ever-ethical Schoenberg. He came to believe that beauty, as understood by a complacent, comfort-obsessed bourgeois society, was no longer true, and therefore, for the sake of truth, their hallowed idea of beauty could no longer hold any value, neither aesthetic nor ethic, for him. Order is an illusion, and following the logic of Keats' dictum, if beauty is no longer true, it likewise ceases to be beautiful. Just as in Das Buch der Hängenden Gärten, ultimately the garden is transformed into a wilderness. Schoenberg finally succeeded in transforming his inherited musical ideas of beauty into what he saw as the music of truth. In his book Harmonielehre of 1911, he wrote that what counts is the capacity to hear oneself, to look deep inside oneself, inside where the man of instinct begins, there, fortunately, theory breaks down. And in his program note for the first performance of Das Buch der Hängenden Gärten, he wrote, "With the Stefan Georg songs, I have for the first time succeeded in approaching an ideal of expression and form which has been in my mind for many years. Until now, I lacked the strength and confidence to make it a reality. I am being forced in this direction, not because my invention or technique is inadequate, but because I am obeying an inner compulsion, which is stronger than any upbringing. I am obeying the formative process which, being the one natural to me, is stronger than my artistic education." In Stefan Georg's original poem, the one thing his dream pursued was something of red-hot, irresistible carnality. For Arnold Schoenberg, like his peers, Karl Kraus and Ludwig Wittgenstein, it was simply the truth. In a later masterpiece, he wrote that in the wilderness, you are invincible. There we had two pieces of wilderness fused into one. We have just listened to two musical depictions of lakes, the first enchanted from Russia, the second still, mysterious and multicolored from Central Europe, both composed in 1909 by Anatol Liadov and Arnold Schoenberg, respectively. Yes, 1908 and 1909 truly were astonishing years for Schoenberg, and I haven't even mentioned three of his most groundbreaking works also composed in the same period. Although in almost every sense these two composers were worlds apart, these two pieces share in their respective and distinctive ways a very heightened awareness of the phenomenon of colour in music. In these two pieces, the textures, created by subtly varying instrumentation, takes the traditional place of themes or harmonic development. This was an aspect of music making that was to be exploited to a huge extent throughout the following years and decades by many composers. I am going to end today's program with a lullaby, although taking into account that it is 36 degrees right now and that it is mid-afternoon, it will probably better serve as a siesta. That was an excerpt from Ferruccio Busoni's Bersuz Elegiac in an arrangement made by John Adams. Last April, I dedicated a piece to my late colleague here at Classical Music Daily, Giuseppe Penisi, in which I wrote about this piece, so I'm not going to say any more about it here. I will simply urge those interested to click on my name on this page, which will enable you to see that piece and anything else I have written for this website. And with that, I'll leave it there for today. So I hope, as always, that you found something interesting or stimulating and that you will continue to listen out for those resounding echoes.